the Mises Academy, Mises Institute Academy class on The Road to Serfdom, Friedrich Hayek's famous book, one of the most famous books of the 20th century. And as far as how the class is going to work, I think most of you probably know already. I usually do about a 45 to 55 minute lecture, overviewing and adding my own commentary on Hayek's writings. And then we usually will follow that with maybe a similar amount of time, if there's interest, in Q&A, mostly through the chat. In the past, Danny and others who work with the Mises Academy have encouraged volume, you know, asking questions that we can hear as long as the sound is okay. But just put some questions on the chat, and at the end of my lecture, I'll go through the chat, and I'll do my best to answer all the questions, and we can go back and forth. And we'll do that for as long as there's interest in doing that. Maybe not until midnight Eastern time, but we'll spend as much time as you want to in doing that. And as far as the course goes, there are five classes. There's no class on Wednesday, July 4th, since a lot of people in the U.S. Take vacations that week. We thought we'd skip that week. And as far as grades, if those of you who would like a grade, I'll make up two quizzes or two exams, one after week two, and then the second one after the week five. And so we'll have sort of a midterm after two classes based on both the readings that are on the syllabus and the class discussions. And then on week after week five, at the end of the class. That way, when you get your certificate for completing the course, if you want to, you can have a grade on the certificate. And in the past, I've made these quizzes either true and false or multiple choice questions of that sort. And you usually will have several days to go online and take it. And so it's not a real high pressure thing. And so that's the format. So there will be exams. If you would like a grade, if you don't want a grade, that's fine too. We're here to learn. That's the great thing about these classes. And so, and let me know as we go if the sound is fading or anything like that. I'll try to sort of keep an eye on the chat group as we go, although a lot of the chat ends up being, hey, did you see that movie last night or something like that sometimes. I guess if the class is not that interesting, that's the way it'll go. But so on the road to serfdom, the importance of the road to serfdom, a lot of you already know the importance of the book. It's when I met Friedrich Hayek in the early 80s when I was on the faculty at George Mason, and he visited twice. And I also met him at Cambridge University in 1984, which was the 40th anniversary of the road to serfdom. And the Monk Pelerin Society meeting was there, and I was in attendance. And Hayek claimed that he wrote most of The Road to Serfdom from sitting on top of the roof of a building at Cambridge University during the Nazi Blitz, looking out for Nazi warplanes. It was his duty. The faculty apparently took turns doing that. He said he never saw any airplanes, but he got most of the book written. And it's quite a story. It's probably false, but that's the story he told. Hayek was a big storyteller and a big leg puller. In fact, I even have a picture. I'm going to get out of the screen for a second here. This is a very old picture of me standing behind Hayek. I think this is around 1983. I'll see if you can see it in the film. It's a group of people at George Mason University, and 1983 is a long time ago, almost 30 years ago. And so that's what Hayek looked like. You can see him sitting there in the middle in front of a bunch of people from George Mason, including me, right directly behind him. And I did get him to sign my copy of The Road to Serfdom. And it's not for sale, but I have two autographed copies of Hayek's books there. Now, the importance of The Road to Serfdom, I guess, is one thing. It's a great book for understanding a lot about how war creates a situation where there is a destruction of civil liberties in particular. And so in terms of the road to serfdom, it's not just big government per se, it's war in particular. After all, Hayek wrote this book in the middle of World War II, and he was seeing how easy it was for the governments to just destroy civil liberties all around the world. Not the German government. He's talking about the British government using war as an excuse. And then, of course, he was also worried that when the war was over, many of these civil liberties that were abolished would not be returned, and as well as economic liberties. And he was fully aware of the fact that during the previous war, World War I, there was tremendous interventionism in the U.S. economy and the European economies, nationalization of industries, price controls, and so forth. And these all created big government bureaucracies that did not disappear after World War I was over. And many of them transformed themselves in with different names, for example, but they maintained the same functions. And so Hayek understood what Robert Higgs became famous for in terms of the ratchet effect of war, whereby the powers of government ratchet up during the war, and then when the war is over, they do not ever ratchet all the way back down to where they started. And so government expands permanently during the war, and correspondingly freedom is diminished as a result, and as is prosperity as a result. And so that's one of the reasons why this is an important book, and it really helps you understand a lot about the threat to liberty and prosperity that war poses. And another important element of the Road to Serfdom is it highlights the importance of the of ideas in guiding events. John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist, famously said something to the effect that human events are ultimately controlled by some defunct philosopher, some defunct economist, something like that. There's a lot of truth in that. For a long time, social scientists have been writing about how whenever there is a big change in the beliefs systems among the public in favor of socialism, in favor of capitalism, or whatever, it usually takes about a generation for those beliefs to become put into place. In other words, 25 years or so. And so in the beginning of The Road to Serfdom, Hayek writes a good bit about how rapidly ideas about freedom that had been built up over centuries were wiped away in Europe and paved the road for totalitarianism in those places. So that's the second most important thing about The Road to Serfdom, in my view, is what you can learn about the importance of ideas that are held in the minds not only of the elites and the academics, but the general public. That's a reason why this has become such a timeless book. Okay, I think somebody's trying to put on the John Maynard Keynes quote there. I think Cam is doing that, our assistant. And so, I'm not going to sit here and quote The Road to Serfdom too much, but there are a lot of good quotes in it. I will highlight some of the ideas, of course, by quoting directly from the book. But on page 17 of my version of The Road to Serfdom, maybe I'll show you my autographed version later. Here's one of the things that Hayek says at the top. We are rapidly abandoning not the views merely of Cobden and Bright, of Adam Smith and Hume, or even of Locke and Milton, but one of the salient characteristics of Western civilization as it has grown from the foundations laid by Christianity and the Greeks and Romans. Not merely 19th and 18th century liberalism, but the basic individualism inherited by us from Erasmus and Montaigne, from Cicero and Tacitus, Pericles and Thucydides, is progressively relinquished. So he's talking about an intellectual war that had taken place in Europe prior to the 1940s against the ideas of liberalism and individualism. And by individualism, Hayek defines that at the bottom of the page. He says this: the essential features of that individualism, which from elements provided by Christianity and the philosophy of classical antiquity, was first fully developed during the Renaissance and has since grown and spread into what we know as Western civilization. They are, and this is what it is, they are the respect for the individual man qua man. That is, the recognition of his own views and tastes as supreme in his own sphere, however narrowly that may be circumscribed, and the belief that it is desirable that men should develop their own individual gifts and bents. That's what individualism means. Respect for the individual and the understanding that no one knows better with regard to what the wishes and goals and objectives of an individual is than that person himself. And we're abandoning that. That's part of the abandoned road. And in its place is the idea that some superior government bureaucrat should dictate to us what our real interests ought to be. And also liberalism, where we had been abandoning liberalism. And one of the reasons I put on the syllabus for tonight, on the reading list, is an article by Benito Mussolini on fascism. And in Mussolini's writings, he was very clear in criticizing liberalism and the ideas of liberalism, European liberalism, not modern American liberalism. And he understood that that was the enemy. The liberal ideas were the enemy. The ideas of freedom, individualism, private property, free markets in economics. And Mussolini himself was very clear in spotting that as the enemy. And the credo of the fascists, who after all is who Hayek is mostly concerned about at this point, fascist Germany and fascist Japan and Italy, when he was writing the book, the credo or the philosophy was the common good before the self-interest. And of course, the common good would always be defined by the government authority. It would never be defined by any plebiscites or any of the people themselves. The people themselves would never decide for themselves what's in their good, in their interest. So the common good before self-interest was always the credo or philosophy, the collectivist philosophy that was being adopted and taking the place of individualism. Also put a couple of chapters of the famous book by von Mises, Liberalism, on the syllabus, since Hayek starts out in The Road to Serfdom saying, well, it would not have been possible for European totalitarianism to become accepted were it not for this war of ideas against liberalism. So what exactly is liberalism? And I urge you to read those chapters. They're very, very clear, very short. Mises was a great writer. And of course, the idea number one is private property. After all, you cannot have a market economy without private property, because that's what is traded. When we talk about trade, and when we talk about voluntary trade in a free market being mutually advantageous, well, what is being traded are property rights, ownership rights to the things that are being traded. And so you cannot have a voluntary economy unless you have property rights. And you cannot have a free market pricing system either unless you have private property. In a regime, and if government is to have a role, its main role is to protect legally and peacefully acquired private property. It's not to protect private property that is acquired by theft or fraud, but peacefully and legally acquired property. That's a different thing altogether. Freedom is a second ingredient of what is known as European liberalism. And of course, by freedom, Hayek means here what the philosophers call negative freedom. There's positive freedom and negative freedom. Negative freedom means freedom from being coerced by others and losing your freedom. Okay, that's freedom from coercion by others. The other type of freedom that has come to be known as positive freedom has to do with redistribution of income and wealth under the auspices of the state. A good example of this would be saying, to be free, I am freer if the government will provide me with a house. And of course, if the government provides me with a free house, yes, I'm freer to live my life as I want because I have a free house, but of course, someone else must be coerced into paying for my house. And so those people who are coerced through taxation to pay for my house are less free. But that's an example of what is meant by positive freedom. And of course, the classical liberals or European liberals always meant negative freedom, freedom from coercion. So it is exactly the opposite idea of the idea of freedom is facilitated by income redistribution or free housing for some segment of the population, or free transportation, free public schooling, on and on and on. Peace. The European liberals always understood that peace is conducive to freedom, and war is not. War is the opposite of capitalism, as far as that is concerned. Also, because capitalism is essentially the free exchange of goods and services among consenting adults. That's all capitalism is. But that is about with war, that is all disruptive. There is no free exchange. People don't trade with each other. They try to kill each other. They blow each other up. They destroy property. They destroy buildings. They burn down cities. So war is the very opposite of capitalism. Capitalism means taking advantage of the international division of labor and specialization that exists around the world, and so that we can all benefit from it. And the essence of capitalism, of course, is that we all specialize in something, and we earn money on the marketplace for that thing if there is a consumer demand for it. And then we use that money to buy things that we are not very good at producing. So I'm not very good at producing cattle and slaughtering them and turning them into steaks. And so I work as a professor and a writer and a speaker, and I make money that way, and I buy steaks from people who know what they're doing. And one of the important aspects of this understanding of what capitalism and markets are is that it shows the fallacy of so-called social Darwinism, where the critics of markets, of capitalism, for well over 100 years have sort of tried to condemn it as being some sort of survival of the fittest philosophy. But it is not at all. If you understand that it relies on the international division of labor, you will understand why that is an explanation of why the least capable people in any society, if it has a market economy, can do okay, can live a decent life and can survive and can do better over time, because they don't need to be smart enough or have the physical ability to build their own house, to farm their own food, to make their own clothing. They rely on people who specialize in those things and who can do it cheaper and cheaper and cheaper as time goes on. And so so that understanding the international division of labor is the key to understanding the fallacy of so-called social Darwinism as a critique of capitalism. And of course, freedom, that's what freedom means in the context of commerce, freedom of commerce. And so the classical liberals always understood that. Hayek in this chapter mentions the Manchester School of Cobden and Bright. If you're not familiar with that, Bright and Cobden were two British businessmen. And there have been several books written about the Manchester School from Manchester, England, Northern England. And they took it upon themselves to wage a crusade for free trade in England. And they succeeded. They formed an organization, they published pamphlets, they made speeches, they got themselves elected to parliament. And by 1850, the year 1850, they did succeed in getting the British government to abolish all tariffs on imports. And so, and that's what Hayek is referring to when he refers to the Manchester School. It was a school of thought, just like the Austrian school was a school of thought. And it made use of the free market ideas of the day from Adam Smith and others, and David Ricardo and the French physiocrats were precursors to the Austrian school. And so they made use of the ideas of free market economics that existed at that time to make the case for free trade, and they succeeded. Friedrich Bastiat was in touch with Cobden and Bright, and he knew them, and Bastiat was doing the same thing in France, although he died in 1850, from tuberculosis, and he didn't achieve as much as Cobden and Bright did politically, but he certainly laid the groundwork for success. And France and much of other parts of Europe did move in the direction of freer trade, like England did at that period of history, thanks to the effort of these men and their ideas. And so that is an excellent example of what Hayek is talking about in The Road to Serfdom when he talks about the importance of ideas in shaping history. They can do it, can work. And peace and freedom are preeminent among those ideas. Equality under the law has always been an element of liberalism, the idea that the law ought to be easily understandable to the average citizen, and the average citizen ought to know in advance what is legal and what is illegal. And the law applies equally to everyone, including presidents, prime ministers, members of parliament, members of Congress, anybody. That's equality under the law. Hayek calls it the rule of law. He's written entire books on the rule of law, and there are debates over this, but that was always a part of what is known as classical liberalism. Also, inequality of income and wealth is also an important part of liberalism. Not equality of income, inequality of income, because of the recognition of the real fact that all human beings are unique. We all have different levels of intelligence. We all have different interests, different specialties in terms of work, different abilities, different levels of strength, and a thousand other things, many, many biological differences among every human being. And so as a result, we engage in different types of work. We start different types of businesses. And as a result, we earn different types of income. And so, and this is to be expected in a free society, inequality of wealth and income, and it is folly and totalitarian for government to try to force equality of income. And so that's another element of what Hayek is talking about here when he talks about liberalism. Tolerance and free speech is another aspect of liberalism. And in terms of the role of government, if you read the chapters on liberalism by von Mises, you'll know that both von Mises and Hayek were not anarchists. They were not anarcho-capitalists. They were advocates of limited constitutional government. Hayek's other famous book, one of his other famous books, after all, is The Constitution of Liberty, and it lays out the case for limited constitutional government. It hasn't worked out that way. In the U.S., government is pretty much unlimited now, despite the Constitution. But that was his belief, and that was also the belief of Mises. Neither of them was an anarcho-capitalist. However, that's not to say that had they lived another 30 or 40 years through some sort of medical miracle, that they might not have become anarcho-capitalists in their very, very old age. And so the fact that they did not embrace the abolition of the defense establishment, for example, does not mean, in my view, that they never would have. Events could have changed their minds as far as that goes. They could have become advocates of the private law system, for example, if they observed how rotten and corrupt the American legal system has become, to give you one example. And so those are some of the main tenets that I would mention when Hayek talks about liberalism: property rights, freedom, peace, equality under the law, inequality of wealth and income in the free market, tolerance and free speech, role of government, and of course, free market economy, or laissez-faire, to use the French term. Okay, and there's another important quote on page 19 where Hayek says, the subsequent elaboration of a consistent argument in favor of economic freedom was the outcome of a free growth of economic activity which had been the undesigned and unforeseen byproduct of political freedom. So he's talking about the European example, European history, and what he's saying is that there was political freedom. Once people had political freedom, the freedom to participate in politics, then they felt free to articulate explanations of the benefits of free markets. Okay, and of course, that is what Adam Smith's famous book, The Wealth of Nations, was all about. At the time when capitalism was developing in Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries, there was a lot of discussion about whether this new system that had been replacing the system of serfdom during the Middle Ages was really good for society as a whole. And Adam Smith explained it in a big long book, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. And of course, his answer was yes, was an explanation of this. And what Hayek is saying here is that it was because of a relatively high degree of political freedom that people like Adam Smith felt free to articulate these ideas and to explain to the public why it is that how commerce worked to begin with, and how it was that it benefited society as a whole and not just any narrow group, which the previous system had done, and all previous systems as far as that's concerned. And you know, another article that I put on the reading list was Hayek's probably his most famous article among academics, anyway, The Use of Knowledge in Society. Now, Hayek is not an easy read. The Road to Serfdom is not an easy read, and nothing that I have ever read of Hayek is particularly easy to read. Now, he has just a certain style, probably because he was so darn smart and so highly intelligent that sometimes it's hard to, if you don't know what he's referring to, for example, mentioning just the Manchester School in passing, if you don't know what the Manchester School was, you might as well be reading comic book pages, you know, you'd be totally out of it. So there's a lot in Hayek like that. But this is his most famous article among academics, The Use of Knowledge in Society. And to get a sort of a magazine version of the importance of this article, I don't have the exact citation here, but there was an article in the New Yorker magazine maybe 10 years ago or so called The Price Prophet, where prophet is spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T. I'm sure you could probably find it on the web. And it was how, when he wrote this article in the 1940s, The Use of Knowledge in Society, he was essentially anticipating a computer age, the internet and the computer age. And so, because, you know, one of the important points about this is that in order for an economy to work and for us to survive and to take advantage of the international division of labor, information must be highly decentralized. It's in the mind, it's information of time and place, to borrow Hayek's phrase. The main type of information that is used is the information that is in the minds of the millions of workers and consumers and business managers and business owners and bankers and everyone who participates in a market economy. And we all do our little jobs in the economy. We all specialize in those things. And then in our own self-interest, we collaborate with other people to produce goods and services, because that's how we can make a better living for ourselves. That's how we can make money and advance our careers and improve our standard of living. And in so doing, we coincidentally benefit our fellow man, because we can only benefit ourselves by providing other people things that they want. We can only get the things that we want, more money, better life, by giving other people the things that they want, goods and services that they want. That's the famous invisible hand theorem of The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. And it's also, you know, Hayek's famous article, The Use of Knowledge in Society, is a more sophisticated rendition of that idea, I think. And probably the most famous rendition of this idea is the essay, I, Pencil, by Leonard Reed, the founder of the Foundation of Economic Education. And I'm sure you can read it online at fee.org, F-E-E.org, or just Google iPencil, you'll find it. And if those of you who have never heard of iPencil, I don't assume that everybody has heard of iPencil necessarily who's taken this class, but it's supposedly a pencil is talking to you, and he's describing all the ingredients of a pencil. And so you just take one ingredient, wood, for a pencil. No human being could possibly produce a pencil, is the theme of the article. No 50 human beings, or maybe even no 100 human beings could possibly produce a pencil. Because if you think about it, what do you need for a pencil? Just one ingredient, wood, among dozens of ingredients that go into the manufacturing of a pencil. Well, you would need trees being grown somewhere, so you'd need a tree farm. You would need all the machines that are used to cut down the trees. You would need a petroleum industry to refine gasoline out of petroleum to gas up the chainsaws and to move the trucks that are used to transport the wood. You would need a lumber yard where the wood is cut up and the wood is somehow transformed into these little cylinders for a pencil. You need all the labor that is involved in that, all the engineering that goes into engineering the tools that are used in the lumbering industry and the paper mill industry and so forth. And so when you think about it, there are hundreds or maybe thousands of people from all over the world who are specializing in something, some aspect of the wood industry. And it goes into the making of a pencil. And that's just one ingredient of a pencil. And so that's the story that is told in iPencil. And it's also the story of the use of knowledge in society. It explains how an economy works by using, and this is called the knowledge problem in economics. And if there's one thing Hayek was famous for in the context of the long 20th century debate over socialism, it was the so-called knowledge problem in pointing out that a socialist economy could never work, the central planning of an economy could never work, because it relies on top-down orders being barked out by a small group of politicians, essentially, and ignores the reality that what really makes an economy work is the decentralized knowledge that is in the minds of millions of people who are participants in the economy. The title of Hayek's Nobel Prize-winning acceptance speech that is published in the American Economic Review is The Pretense of Knowledge. He called this The Pretense of Knowledge. It's a pretension that a small group of government planners could possibly possess in their minds the knowledge of time and place that is in the minds of millions of people that is necessary to make an economy, like even a small economy, operate, not necessarily even the U.S. economy. Okay, and so that's what he's talking about when he talks about around page 20 or so about spontaneous order. I think he does use the word spontaneous, and the spontaneous order of markets is another type of language that is often used here to describe this. Moving on a little bit to the second chapter I put on the syllabus. I see we have some writing, some quotations by Hayek, Political Anarchy. Okay. But anyway, moving on, Hayek points out that the founders of socialism reviled and hated freedom of thought, freedom of speech, because, you know, socialism does require, is above all else, the dictating of a social plan on the rest of society. That's also why Hayek, in a later chapter that we'll talk about, made the argument that socialism and democracy are inherently incompatible, because you cannot allow people to vote out your plan. Socialism requires some sort of central plan for society, and that's why the advocates of socialism have always been champions of centralized monopolistic governmental power, because that's what socialism is. It's the imposition of a central plan on the whole society. And he does talk about the need for a dictatorship. In order to have socialism, you need dictatorship. Now, in terms of what socialism is, at the time Hayek was writing The Road to Serfdom, the accepted definition was government ownership of the means of production. But beginning in the 1976 edition of The Road to Serfdom, Hayek said that that definition, by the time he wrote The Road to Serfdom, that definition was pretty much being abandoned by socialists themselves. And the socialists themselves had come to define socialism as income redistribution through the auspices of the welfare state and the progressive income tax. That's what socialism came to mean. And Hayek says there that, after all, the ostensible goal of socialism was always income equality. It was like the redistribution of income from the bourgeois to the proletariat and so forth. And so that's always the objective of socialists. And so they just changed their tactic. They decided, well, we don't have to take over all the factories. We can allow the factories to exist and then confiscate a huge amount of the income of the factory owners and then give it away to people that we prefer to give it away to. And so that's what socialism came to mean. And Hayek started writing that in the 1970s in the different editions to The Road to Serfdom. And in terms of the what I said earlier about positive versus negative freedom, Hayek does touch upon this. And one example of this, a clear example of this, you could Google, is Franklin Roosevelt's Economic Bill of Rights. And this is a perfect example of so-called positive freedom. And FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, in his famous speech on an Economic Bill of Rights, he said that, you know, every American should have a house, they should have a good job with a good wage, a good education. And of course, these were all government programs that he was advocating. And he was also advocating that other people be made to pay for all these things. And Hayek is referring to these things and how in Europe, even before the U.S., these ideas cut off. And the older idea of negative freedom was replaced by positive freedom, which essentially means a nation of freeloaders, people freeloading off the labor of others for their houses and their cars and everything else. And another important point to keep in mind here when you read The Way to Serfdom is Hayek does say that socialism, fascism, communism, they're all basically the same thing. They're just a variety of collectivism. And so he didn't really distinguish a great deal between all these isms. And he points out that all the famous fascists like Mussolini and Hitler did start out as calling themselves socialists. And of course the Nazi Party was the National Socialist Party. That's where the acronym Nazi stood for, is National Socialism. And I did put on the syllabus, on the reading list for tonight's class, the online version of the 25-point program of the Nazi Party of 1925. And apart from a few things condemning the Jews and things like that and talking about the fatherland, it's pretty much the New Deal. There's Social Security or old age insurance in there. There's a welfare state in there, progressive taxation, usury laws. And so it's pretty much a condemnation of capitalism. Hitler called it the Jewish materialistic spirit. It's pretty much the FDR's New Deal is very similar to the things that are in the 25-point program of the Nazi Party. That's why in the 1920s, before the world knew who Adolf Hitler really was, statesmen from all over the world embraced his economic policies. The same with Mussolini. When Mussolini wrote his autobiography, which is comically entitled My Autobiography, it's sort of like if a third grade teacher asked her class to write a two-page biography, what would you call it? Well, a third grader might call it My Autobiography. That's what Benito Mussolini called his autobiography. The foreword to it was written by Richard Washburn Child, the American ambassador to Italy at the time, who called Mussolini the greatest statesman of our time. Winston Churchill, excuse me, once said, this was in the 30s, the early 30s, he said, had I been Italian, I would have donned the fascist black shirt. The Italian fascists wore black shirts as their sort of uniform, like their identification. And that, of course, was long before Mussolini joined in with Hitler to wage war on England, that Winston Churchill said that. But when these politicians from England and America and elsewhere were just looking at the economic program of the fascists, they kind of liked it. It was pretty much sounded like the New Deal, and even much of the New Deal was based on European fascism, as far as that's concerned. It was essentially the same thing. It was called corporatism in Europe, but it was called managed capitalism in America. But it was essentially the same type of thing. Okay. And so in this second chapter, Hayek does talk about the impossibility of democratic socialism. And I don't want to steal my own thunder because we're going to talk about that a good bit more in future chapters. And so keep in mind there's two definitions of socialism. One of the big myths that was very especially effective apparently in Europe that helped pull the wool over people's eyes with regard to the reality of capitalism and markets was this slogan that is, you still hear it today, of that an economy should have production for use but not for profit. You still hear that today, maybe not in those exact words, but you still hear some version of production for use but not for profit. Now, what does this mean? Well, it's a total economic fallacy because in a market economy, you cannot profit unless you produce some good or service that other people find useful. If they do not find it useful, they will not buy it, they will not give you money for it, and you will go broke. You will not have any profit. And so, but the socialists of the 19th and early 20th centuries got away with this sloganeering, which to this day is still repeated. I see it or a version of it all the time. Put the government in charge and they will provide things that are really useful for people and they're not just interested in profit. But in a genuine market economy, the only way to profit, of course, is to provide things that other people decide are useful. Not things that politicians think are useful. You know, most of the stuff that the government gives us is just stuff that is dreamed up by politicians who tell us that we need these things. We need another war in Syria, for example, here in the U.S. that the people are telling us. So we supposedly need this. It's in the public interest to start more wars in Syria and Iran. That's what they're telling us now, for example. And the people typically have nothing whatsoever to do with this sort of thinking. But that's what Hayek is talking about here. You know, production for use, production that is beneficial to people. Yeah, that's different from production for profit, the socialist would say. It's exactly the opposite of the truth. And we're going to be, Hayek talks a lot in the rest of the book about planning. The whole book is a critique of government planning, essentially. And one of his real essential arguments is to point out that of course everybody plans. Every family plans, every individual plans, makes plans for his life. You know, you make plans for the day, you make plans for your career, for your school. College students plan their schedules. Mothers plan how they're going to raise their children, as do fathers. People plan their marriages. We always plan. We're constantly planning things we're going to do. And so the debate during Hayek's time over planning was all centered on who should do the planning. Who is it to do the planning? Are we going to give people the freedom to plan their own affairs, or are we going to have some sort of government dictatorship order us to obey their plan? You know, whose plans are to count here? What type of society do you want to live in, where you are free to plan your own life, or the alternative, you are a slave who is ordered to plan your life in the way others want you to live your life? And that's why at one point Hayek comments that socialism is slavery. If you really want to have any form of socialism, it really is slavery. And of course, if you look at income taxation, the pipe dream of every socialist would be to use the income tax to tax away, you know, 70% or 80% or more of everyone's income, and leaving us all with subsistence level wages, so that they could use the money to plan the whole society. That would be the ideal pipe dream of every socialist. And it's also important to understand that in reading The Road to Serfdom, Hayek, there are a lot of economic lessons there. Even though it's a book in political philosophy, Hayek was, after all, a world-famous economist at the time. He wrote the book, and it did win the Nobel Prize in 1974 for economics, not for political philosophy. And so all throughout the book, there are economic lessons. And in passing, in the third chapter, he talks about the price system, the role of the price system. And the contrast he makes is between, should we use competition to allocate resources in society, or should we use political dictatorship? Okay, and of course, it's in our societies today, it's always a matter of degree. You know, the degree to which we allow markets to work versus the degree to which government allocates resources for us. It's never an either-or choice that we have. And he does sort of a quick and dirty exposition of the bad effects or ill effects of price controls. An easy-to-read article of mine on the web on Mises.org is entitled 40 Centuries of Price Controls, that you can find. It's a book review, essentially, of a book by that title by Eamon Butler and a co-author. So you might want to look that up if you haven't read about price controls. But essentially, when the government tries to control prices, if it dictates that prices must be below the going market price, what it does is, well, people will want to buy more at the lower price, but at the same time, they will take some of the profit out of producing and supplying that good or service. And therefore, there's lower supply but higher demand. And as a result, you're going to have shortages. And shortages were the main characteristic of all the socialist economies of any type, whether you call it fascism, socialism, or whatever. And so price controls always create economic chaos. And Hayek refers to that. So in laying out the first initial argument of the Road to Serfdom, he frames it in the context of are we going to allow competition? And most people think competition is a good thing. Well, that's another word for markets. or political dictatorship. If you have political dictatorship, you don't have prices being determined by supply and demand. You have prices being determined arbitrarily by politicians. And what's so virtuous about supply and demand, of course, is, well, that's how we can make rational economic calculations based on economic reality. If you're the manufacturer of a product, for example, and the price of some input that you use to produce your product, say you're a car manufacturer, and the price of rubber goes up that you use in some parts of the car, well, that tells you, well, maybe you should start looking for substitutes for rubber. And it also tells the manufacturers of substitutes or would-be substitutes that there's money in it. There's money in it now of producing those substitutes. And so people respond to incentives like this, guided along by the price system. As a consumer, when things get more expensive, we know it's time to conserve because it's more expensive. Why is it more expensive? Well, it's probably because it's more scarce at the time. So conserve, cut back, don't use as much. And these are the price signals, some of the price signals that we get from markets. And trying to have an economy without free market prices is like trying to navigate through a strange city where there are no street signs. And Hayek understood that, of course, being a world-class economist, but you don't need to be a world-class economist. You just need to know a little bit. For those of you who have not studied economics per se yet, Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt is a great starting book, and also Power and Market by Rothbard, by Murray Rothbard, is a good introductory to basic economics. And now Hayek, as I said, he was an advocate of limited government, and he was also a utilitarian. So if you read through the first couple of chapters of The Road to Serfdom, he makes the argument for the government producing so-called public goods. He makes an argument for all sorts of intervention, for patents, for government regulation of health and safety and so forth. And he basically says if it can be shown that the social benefits outweigh the social costs, there should be no objection to the government doing it. And so he certainly was not an anarchist by any means. He was, in fact, if you read a lot from Hayek in The Road to Serfdom as well as The Constitution of Liberty, a case can be made that he was a European social democrat on policy. He advocated a lot more interventions in the economy than Mises did, or that certainly than Murray Rothbard did. And so he was no anarchist by any stretch of the imagination, but that doesn't mean that this is still not a very important book in terms of its warnings about the road to serfdom and the road to tyranny, as far as what he had to say here. And here's, for example, on page 45, let me read from the horse's mouth, as we say. He says, he's talking about, quoting Adam Smith, about different types of government intervention that could be advantageous to a great society. There are of such a nature that profit could never repay the expense to any individual or small number of individuals. He's talking about so-called public goods. He says, these tasks provide indeed a wide and unquestioned field for state activity. In no system that could be rationally defended would the state just do nothing. So that's pretty much a clear statement of Hayek disavowing what is called anarcho-capitalism today. He was much more of an interventionist, certainly, than Rothbard and more than Mises, although Mises also was not an anarcho-capitalist. And so, essentially, planning, Hayek understood that government planning in his time was essentially a movement against competition. And it wasn't just socialism. At the time, in a future chapter of The Road to Serfdom, talk about the kind of planning that had been going on in the early 20th century was a government takeover of the so-called utility industries, electric power, natural gas, water supply. The so-called natural monopoly argument was made for either government running of these industries, government takeover, or the government granting of monopoly franchises to private companies that were then regulated by government. So sort of the de facto nationalization or state ownership of these companies that provide electric power, water supply, natural gas, and a few other things. And that is part of what Hayek is referring to here. It's not just socialism in the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany, but it's also the replacement of genuine competition with government-run monopolies, supposedly in the name of planning. You can look up an article of mine. There's a critique of this idea. It's called The Myth of Natural Monopoly. It was published in the Review of Austin Economics quite a few years ago, but it's online, and it discusses just what the title says, the myth of natural monopoly, and these types of monopolies, that government monopolies that replaced competition, were done in the name of planning, economic planning, at least in that area of the economy. The final comment I'll make here about these couple of chapters is, do read, if at all possible, the essay by Ralph Rako on It's a Short History of Classical Liberalism. And this is the abandoned road that Hayek talks about in Chapter 1, The Road is Abandoned, Classical Liberalism. And one of the important points Rako makes there is that one of the things that led to a much higher degree of freedom in Europe after the Middle Ages was political decentralization. And there were a great many individual cities, free cities, and a large number of small countries at one time in history. And the importance of that is that if one particular country was ruled by a tyrant, then people could move very easily to another country. Or if a city was ruled by a tyrant, you could move to the next city. And so there was competition among governments, and it at least allowed an exit route, an escape route from higher degrees of tyranny. And so, but tyranny is tyranny. He did not argue that there was no tyranny at all in any of these governments. It was all relative. But the argument is that decentralized political power, in this sense, was one of the reasons why there was a burst of freedom in Europe. Because after all, if one government would be founded on the basis of like Hong Kong 25 years ago, before the Chinese government took it over, Hong Kong is still a relatively free country compared to most other countries in the world. But certainly before the Chinese took over Hong Kong, they had a 10% flat income tax and essentially a laissez-faire economy. If you had dozens of competing governments in Europe at one time in history, and you had a Hong Kong there, and as a result, that country was 10 times more prosperous than anybody else, you can bet your life that a lot of the other governments would follow suit. They would want to copy that. That's how the politicians would become popular. So you would be appealing to the self-interest of politicians and acquiescing in freedom because that's what made people prosperous. They would surely eventually get to work and try to destroy much of that freedom, as politicians always do. But that's the idea that Ralph Rako is talking about here when he talks about political decentralization. And this is very relevant to the Road to Serfdom, because the great evil that Hayek is talking about in the Road to Serfdom is centralized governmental power, whether it was the Soviet Union, the American Union, Mussolini's Italy, fascist Japan. It all became possible because of highly centralized monopolistic governmental power. Had the government of Germany not become almost totally centralized and the rights of the citizens of the German states essentially abolished by Otto von Bismarck in the 19th century, the Nazis would have just been another gang of crazy skinhead lunatics with weird ideas. They would never have been able to do what they did, because there would not have been some giant government with huge taxing powers available for the grabbing by people like this. And so had Europe remained as decentralized as it was 100, 200 years earlier, this could never have happened. But the whole trend of the late 19th, early 20th century was the opposite of centralization of political power, not decentralization. And so do try to read that article. It's actually three short articles by Ralph Rako on the history of liberalism. Okay. And so I see Cam put the myth of natural monopoly up there somewhere. So that's 7:25. I've gone on pretty much long enough for now. And so what I'll do now is I'll look over and see if there's some questions or comments. Ask me about almost anything related to the course. And I'll just go through the chat here and see if we've got some questions. So give me a minute or two, and I'll see if there are and you can continue to type in questions now. Let's see, Malcolm Arnold is writing, Chapter 1, German ideas were being adopted worldwide. Why was this? To what extent were the ideas of Freud and Darwin driving this? The idea that science could conquer anything, including social engineering. What Hayek was talking about there is, you know, there were German classical liberals that were very important in contributing the ideas that Hayek would approve of. But in this chapter, he's talking about mostly there was something called the German Historical School. And it was a school of statism. He mentions one part in this chapter that many American college students went to Europe, Germany, and elsewhere in Europe, to college, and then they came back thinking the only political debate that there was to decide whether they were a fascist or a socialist, or a communist, rather. One or the other. Either you're a fascist or you're a communist. And they were apparently totally unaware of classical liberalism. Most of my students at Loyola University, Maryland today are like that. I brought Walter Williams in as a guest speaker at a speaker series that I run, and he has a great canned speech called The Legitimate Role of Government in a Free Society. And he essentially espoused the views of a Friedrich Hayek on constitutional liberty. And the students were mystified. These were all sophomores, juniors, and seniors for the most part, and they had never heard this before. They never heard these arguments before. Some of them were even dumbfounded that they realized they were 20 years old, and they hear him quoting Jefferson, Madison. You know, why have I never been taught these things, they said. And that's what was going on in Europe, that the ideas of classical liberalism, of which Germans had an important role to play in earlier days, had been eclipsed by the German historical school, which became very influential. A lot of the American economists studied there in Germany and came back to America to spread their statist interventionist ideas here. And so that's what Hayek is referring to. And it was all the influence of some prominent European academics. And they had American disciples, and that's how these ideas got spread. For example, one of the co-founders of the American Economic Association in the 1880s was Richard T. Ely, E-L-Y, is how he spelled his name. And he was educated in Germany. He came back to America, taught at Johns Hopkins, and he became very prominent. He went to the University of Wisconsin later in his career, and he espoused interventionist ideas. And it's odd that he was a founder of the American Economic Association, because the heart of a lot of what he taught, what he was known for, was disavowing the laws of economics and just sort of making ad hoc recommendations based on torturous interpretations of statistics that were always used to justify government intervention in the economy. And so it was really the American Anti-Economic Association, to the extent that Richard T. Ely was involved in it. And so that's what Hayek was talking about here when German ideas were spread. He wasn't talking about Freud. He was talking about the German historical school. Yes, let's see, the Mises Institute, I guess Cam is quoting Albert Einstein. Yeah, Albert Einstein was a proud socialist. This goes to show you that you can be very clever and smart in one area and a total brainless idiot in other areas. You know, having intelligence to do physics problems does not make you an expert in all areas of the world. My former professor, James M. Buchanan, won the Nobel Prize in 1986. And when he held his press conference, the very first thing he said to the media was, winning the Nobel Prize does not make me an instant expert at everything, so don't ask me about everything. And he even said, don't ask me about the government deficit, I'm not going to comment on even that. and after winning the Nobel Prize. But that's what Einstein apparently was like. He thought that since he's Einstein, he knows everything about everything. So he even wrote a little pamphlet about socialism and how good it is, what a good idea it was. Here's my article on price control in here. Okay, Malcolm is asking, does Hayek ever discuss, in his opinion, how government intervention will not inevitably lead to socialism? Well, yes, he was very, very optimistic about the role of ideas. That's why he wrote the book, he said. In fact, if you look at the book, he dedicates the book to socialism, to socialists of all parties. That's the dedication. So he thought that he could maybe persuade some of them. Here's what it says there. Let's even read that to the socialists of all parties. And the dedication in the part of the word serfdom. And so he was optimistic that the ideas, since ideas, the bad ideas superseded classical liberal ideas, he thought the tide could be turned again. And he thought that, he understood that it was the ideas of, let me put it this way, capitalism and freedom prospered in much of Europe during the 18th, 19th centuries and 20th part of the 20th century because there was a culture of ideas that the public came to accept about the propriety of private property and peace and economic freedom and all these things. Those ideas were diluted by socialist ideas in the academic world, which filtered into the rest of the population eventually. And so Hayek was participating in the battle of ideas here. And there is a video interview of Hayek with James Buchanan. You can go online and find James M. Buchanan, my old professor, who was also a colleague of mine for a few years with George Mason, interviewing Friedrich Hayek. And in that interview, Hayek says that how remarkable it was when he won the Nobel Prize in 1974, the tide was finally turning, the tide of ideas. You know, so the dark days of interventionism were the 1940s and 50s and 60s and into the 70s. But then he won the Nobel Prize and he knew, and at the time of the interview, I think the interview was about 1980, 1979, and Hayek was optimistic at that point. He saw the tide turning in terms of ideas. He saw Margaret Thatcher ascending in England. And of course, I'm not saying she was the perfect politician, but she did. She was a devotee of Hayek in particular. And so he saw that happening, and he thought ideas could be important. He knew the socialists certainly thought ideas were important, and so why can't our side look at it the same way, is what he was saying. Graham Peterson wants to know, in a nutshell, the primary differences in the philosophy between Mises and Hayek. Well, there are quite a few differences, and you can't put them in a nutshell or an eggshell or anything like that. They had a great deal in common, of course, because they were both educated in much of the same literature of classical liberalism. Hayek was Mises' student, and so when Hayek writes about liberalism, classical liberalism, or European liberalism, he must have been thinking of the book by von Mises on liberalism as far as those ideas are concerned. So they were in agreement on most things. On the economic sphere, in the big battle over socialism, Hayek is most known for the knowledge problem, for pointing out that socialism could never work because of the necessity of decentralized knowledge in economy. Mises is more known for what's called the calculation problem, the economic calculation problem, where the argument is, in a nutshell, I can make that argument, that in order to have rational economic calculation of profit and loss in economy, for example, that's what tells you whether you're adding value or destroying value in as a business person. In order to do that, you have to have free market pricing of everything. In order to have free market pricing, you have to have private property, because that's what is traded, is property. And so when property is traded, that's what determines market prices, trading of property in markets. And that's what guides us along and tells us what types of inputs to use in producing goods and services. It guides us along in telling us whether or not we're making profits or losses. For example, it tells us what the real cost of things are in terms of use of the opportunity cost of the resources we're using. And so von Mises is known more for criticizing socialism on grounds of the economic calculation problem, that in a socialist economy where you did not have free market prices and you did not have private property, rational economic calculation would be impossible and you would have economic chaos. And not only that, but another important part of Mises' argument was that there's a whole culture of commerce that builds up. People become specialists in banking and capital markets and insurance and in transportation and things of that sort in a market economy. In a socialist economy, everyone's a government bureaucrat. No one has much of an incentive to develop true expertise in these things. There is no stock market, for example. And the stock market is how capital is moved from less productive to more productive uses in a free market economy. And so so rational economic calculation becomes totally impossible. The socialists of the world finally admitted that. There's an essay by Robert Heilbronner, a famous socialist economist of the last century. His last name is spelled H-E-I-L-B-R-O-N-E-R. The article is called After Communism. It was in the September 10th, 1990 issue of the New Yorker magazine. And in it he said Mises was right. Those are his exact words about why socialism could never fail. So well, this was a man who was at the time, I think he was at least 80 years old, a very famous socialist academic in America, who made his career preaching socialism, advocating socialism, and this was a big mea culpa. Mises was right, I was wrong. But then at the end of the article, he advises his fellow socialists to hide behind the banner of environmentalism and continue to promote socialist central planning, but doing it in the name of saving the planet and the earthworms and the mosquitoes and everything else, you know, Mother Nature. Okay, Bob Trumbo wants to know where we draw the line about what's permissible for government and what isn't. The slippery slope, well, there is no line that I could tell you about. This is a question of political philosophy. There are, as far as libertarians go, there are many of them. There are limited government libertarians who believe that the government should do only what the U.S. Constitution gives it the powers to do. But then there are those like me who understand that the Constitution was pretty much trashed many generations ago because of the relentless pressures to ignore limitations on the Constitution. I wrote a whole book on this called Hamilton's Curse. That at the time of the American founding, Alexander Hamilton, the first American Treasury Secretary, worked diligently almost as soon as the ink was dry on the original Constitution to undermine the Constitution by inventing such notions as implied powers of the U.S. Constitution as opposed to the specifically delegated powers of the Constitution, which are in Article 1, Section 8. And so the Constitution was never successful for more than maybe 5 years in limiting the central government. Especially once the central government was given the power to tax, that pretty much meant the gig was up and that the citizens of the states would eventually become serfs of the central government. And so there is no clear line based on any kind of on economics or science or anything like that, but all I could do is recommend that you educate yourself more and more on this. For example, traditional conservatives and a lot of libertarians will say, well, government does have a role in the maintaining law and order and the police in the court system. But go and read Bruce Benson's book, The Enterprise of Law, about how law evolved historically in the private sector. The common law evolved privately, and governments eventually took it over. And so, and also there's a lot been, certainly a lot been written about the corruption and inefficiency of government law enforcement, because everything the government does is corrupt and inefficient. You can make a case that, a very easy case to make nowadays, that the so-called National Defense Establishment in America is not a defense establishment, but an offense establishment, and it makes life much more dangerous for Americans by making enemies for us all over the world. And so you can make a case for private national defense, too. It's all up to you to make that case. There's a book called The Myth of National Defense, edited by Hans Hoppe. And so I would recommend that. I would recommend The Enterprise of Law by Bruce Benson. And there's also an article that's widely cited in libertarian circles entitled The Not-So-Wild Wild West by Harry Anderson and Harry Anderson is the first author, and PJ somebody, I know Middle Block or the author's name, maybe Cam or somebody will remember it. It was in the Journal of Libertarian Studies around 1979. I keep thinking PJ O'Rourke, but it wasn't PJ O'Rourke. But Harry Anderson is the principal author. And it makes the case that the American frontier was essentially a private law society, where even the wagon trains that went out from the East Coast to the West had their own constitutions, their own laws, and so forth. The mining camps had their own private police, private laws, and so forth. And so if you want a good answer to this question, you really have to read up on the privatization of law and even the privatization of national defense, because those are the two hardest things that people have trouble getting their minds around and thinking of. And what we call anarcho-capitalism. How can we get along without a military establishment, without government police tasering us left and right? But there is a lot of good literature on that by some very smart people. Let's see. Matt Latour writes, in the Road to Serfdom, Hayek states, nor is the preservation of competition incompatible with an extensive system of social services so long as the organization is not designed as a way to make competition ineffective. Where would Hayek draw the line with current welfare states in Europe? Well, to answer that question in the context of the Road to Serfdom, there, he's a utilitarian. He's saying as long as you can show that the social benefits outweigh the social cost, government should do it. But of course, there's a huge literature now on the failure of the welfare state. One of the most famous books is called Losing Ground by Charles Murray. And I think that Hayek was probably familiar with Losing Ground. I know that Charles Murray had met Hayek, and this book, Losing Ground, was published in 1984. And so even using his own utilitarian calculus, benefit-cost calculus, I think Hayek would have backed off from the welfare state late in life, even though he was a utilitarian, as opposed to someone like Rothbard, who would oppose the welfare state not just on utilitarian grounds, that it's destructive of the work ethic, it's destructive of families, and so forth, but it's a gross act of legalized theft, and is therefore immoral, and the government has no role in doing it. Hayek would not make that argument. He'd make a utilitarian argument. I see Cam found the video of James Buchanan interviewing Hayek. That's great. I think that's what that is on the chat here. It's on YouTube. Everything is on YouTube. Let's see. David Dinsdale wants me to ponder on what's going on right now in Europe and connect it to the course. We're seeing the collapse of the European welfare state and of the European Union. And it's hyper-regulatory state. The Greek welfare state is collapsing. And unfortunately for German taxpayers, they're bailing out a lot of their fellow welfare status. And so a lot of what I see going on in Europe is all good. It's all the collapse of the welfare states. And you have the public employee unions rioting in Greece and elsewhere, in France and elsewhere. And they're showing their true colors. Government is all about them. It's all about plundering the taxpayer for their benefit and their cushy pensions. similar thing is happening in America, state by state. There were exposés in the media a year or so ago about, for example, a city manager of a small town of 90,000 people in California who retired at age 50 on a pension of $800,000 a year for life. And there, and story after story like this came up. And so it got a lot of people thinking, well, how much is the fireman making, you know, a pension? And it turns out there are a lot of firemen, or firefighters, as they call themselves in America, who make six-figure pensions in their 50s for the rest of their lives. And of course, it's bankrupting cities and states all over America. And so this is reality, and I think it's the only thing that's going to force people, politicians, to face reality is bankruptcy. And so I'm cheering them on. I'm going to go bankrupt, Greece. Don't bail them out. And of course, what's happening in Europe underlines the importance of ideas, too. Because if all you have is the ideas of, like Paul Krugman of the New York Times would say, the only problem Greece has is their welfare state is not big enough. It needs to be bigger. Because at the heart of Keynesian economics, I can define Keynesian economics in one sentence. You don't need to take an entire course in macroeconomics. You don't need to read the General Theory by John Maynard Keynes. You just need to understand that their basic belief is that if the government uses force, intimidation, coercion, and violence to take money out of the pockets of hardworking taxpayers and give it to bureaucrats to spend, that will create prosperity. That's it. That's Keynesian economics. You don't need to know any more than that, really. That's essentially it. And so that's why you have people like New York Times columnist Paul Krugman writing column after column after column after column saying, Greece, the problem in Greece and France is government is not big enough. If they would only double taxes and spend more money, everything would be fine. And so, of course, they have been doing that year after year. I'm cheering them on. You know, the more bankruptcy, the better in Europe. Because that's the only chance they have of getting rid of their welfare state in a crisis of that sort. Dirk Deaton wants me to expound how 25 points put forth by the Nazis resembles FDR's ideas. You can go through that yourself, item by item, and you can see social insurance, old age insurance, compulsory education, a welfare state, and so all the elements of the New Deal, many of the elements of the New Deal. FDR was very, very critical. He blamed the depression on capitalism. He called businessmen economic royalists, and he imposed sort of Nazi-style price controls on his economy. And I plan on talking more about that in a future class, so I don't want to steal my own thunder. But for now, just read through that list and ask yourself how many things we have here in America that are kind of like that. And there are a lot of them, not every single one, but a lot of them are like that. Just the welfare state alone is FDR's economic bill of rights. Let's see, Jose is asking if Hayek was for government intervention. Did he ever explain how government spending after the flow of information to make it possible for the market to allocate resources? I think you're saying how he would control this. I'm not sure what this question is exactly, but Hayek was much more optimistic about democracy than certainly than I am, or than Rothbard would have been, or than Mises even would have been. And if you watch that interview with James Buchanan and Hayek, that's one of the questions he asked about democracy, about how to control government. He thought democracy could do the trick as long as people had freedom of speech and could persuade the public about some of these better ideas, such as the ones that form the whole classical liberal idea, regime of ideas. And so I don't know, there's James asking a question about the Nazi Party and Golden Dawn. I don't know anything about that. Maybe if some of you do, you can feel free to add something here. I'll look at the Q&A panel in a minute. See, Rako talks about Hayek's not being admitted to the Econ Department of Chicago. Oh yeah, he wasn't. Milton Friedman vetoed it because Milton Friedman was the sort of dogmatic positivist. His economic methodology was called positivism, which involved trying to sort of ape or imitate physics and the physical sciences, where economists were said to develop hypotheses and then test them with statistics and econometrics, and Hayek did not disavow the use of statistics, but he did not believe in prediction because statistics and econometrics, as used by economists, are all based on historical statistics, and an economic relationship that occurred over the past 20 years is not necessarily going to be the same over the next 20 years. For example, economists who try to measure the price elasticity of demand of oranges. And a lot of things could change in the future. So if you get a certain number for the price elasticity demand for oranges based on historical data over the past 20 years, well, what if a new report comes out saying oranges, because of the chemicals sprayed on orange trees in Florida, oranges may be carcinogenic? Well, then the elasticity of demand is totally going to change. And so Hayek did not believe on making predictions based on statistics and econometrics, and he did not use the method that Milton Friedman used. And so Friedman, who was the leader of the Chicago University of Chicago Economics Department, vetoed his job application in the Economics Department. And this has been made public. This is not a conspiracy theory that I'm espousing. This is pretty well known now. And so Hayek did teach at Chicago in something called, the department was called the Committee on Social Thought, and Ralph Rako was one of his students. And so Ralph Rako's PhD is from the University of Chicago, and Hayek was his professor at the University of Chicago. And so he knows what he's talking about. He wrote his dissertation under Hayek. Let's see, Malcolm Arnold, in Chapter 1, Hayek mentions regulations in a prior era restricting innovation. What was different about mining and watchmaking when it didn't have regulations? I always talk about Europe, so I don't really know that part of European history. But I think that's the part where he says that if a case can be made that the benefits outweigh the cost for mining regulation, we should have them to protect job safety and that sort of thing. But we didn't have a lot of industries developed in those days. The fact that they don't have government regulation doesn't mean there was no safety. Because I think you have to understand that the way the market works in the context of safety in something like mining is that if somebody has an accident in a workplace, in a mine, it makes that workplace more dangerous than other types of workplace. And in order to get people to come to work there where it's dangerous, employers have to offer higher pay. And so it literally costs employers money, and it reduces their profits if they have a more dangerous workplace. That gives them a powerful motivation to do whatever they can to improve the safety of the workplace. And of course, you're never going to eliminate accidents because human beings are human beings. But the market and the profit motive gives a very powerful incentive to take safety precautions. And of course, not all business people are responsible and intelligent, just as not all professors are responsible and intelligent, and not all, fill in the blank. So this doesn't mean you'll never have accidents in the free market, of course, or anything like that. But the free market profit motive does provide a very powerful incentive to provide a safer and safer workplace because there's money in it. And also, another cost you would bear is the lost productivity of the employee and the cost of retraining the replacements, the threat of lawsuits, and so forth. And so it's not too surprising that in the development of capitalism, They went many years in industries as dangerous as mining without government regulations. That doesn't mean they had no regulations. They had privately imposed regulations by the corporations, by the businesses, because it was in their personal economic self-interest to have these regulations. And again, the question is, who is to do the planning, politicians or individuals? He wants to read, somebody wants, Cam wants me to redefine Keynesian economics. Yeah, sure. Keynesian economics is defined by the idea that the government can use force, intimidation, coercion, and violence to forcefully take money out of the pockets of hard-working taxpayers and give it to government bureaucrats to spend in order to create prosperity. So that's what creates prosperity. It's taking money out of the pockets of the taxpayers, out of the bank accounts of the taxpayers, and letting government bureaucrats spend it. That's what creates prosperity, because the bottom line behind every Keynesian argument is more government spending. And more government spending has to come out of the private sector one way or another, either through taxes, borrowing that crowds out private borrowing, or price inflation caused by money creation. And so that's what Keynesian economics is. Let me see if there was a, if I can click on the Q&A here. Let's see, I have some of the same questions. Let's see. There's one question here that's truncated, it stops in the middle of a sentence, so I'm going to go off to other one. And it continues on here. I can't understand some of these. There's one question, can we find parallels in the 19th century German state to the current development of the European Union? Well, yes, Otto von Bismarck, Chancellor of Germany, did a great deal to abolish states' rights in Germany and to neuter the ability of the citizens of the German states to have influence over the central government. And so that's why if you were to read Mein Kampf, Adolf Hitler's famous book, Mein Kampf, there was a chapter back in the 28s or something, back in the 20s, on federalism, states' rights, and state sovereignty, where Adolf Hitler himself praised Otto von Bismarck to the treetops for almost totally destroying states' rights, but not totally. And so in Mein Kampf, Hitler was promising to totally destroy states' rights so that the citizens themselves would not have any vehicle at all to influence their central government. Central government would be a dictatorship. That's what Hitler wanted, and Bismarck moved in that direction. In the late 19th century was the century when there was a great move to centralize political power. And in my book, The Real Lincoln, I quote Edmund Wilson, the famous historian Edmund Wilson, who wrote a book on war, one of his many books. And he pointed out that Abraham Lincoln, Stalin in Russia, and Hitler in Germany did more than any single individual in their respective countries to introduce centralized governmental power in those countries. He didn't say Lincoln was just like Hitler or anything like that, but he did say that one thing these three men had in common is that they did more than any others in their respective countries to usher in centralized governmental power and to destroy federalism or states' rights, which was the original American system. And it was also a system that existed in Germany and elsewhere, and certainly all of Europe in previous times. And so the lesson of that period was that all of this tyranny and war and economic destructiveness was a direct result of the centralization of political power. we finally see the total collapse of centralized power, the collapse of socialism in the Soviet Union and in Eastern and Central Europe. And so what do Europeans do in response? They say, well, what we need is more centralized political power. Let's call it the European Union and centralized economic central planning in Brussels. And so that's what, so it's a truly rotten system that is very much at odds with how Europe became prosperous in the first place several hundred years ago. And it really is moving all of Europe on the road to serfdom when they had a golden opportunity to move in the opposite direction with the collapse of communism in the late 80s and early 90s. So that's why, you know, here's one anecdote about the EU. That there was an open-air market in London that remained open even during the Nazi blitz. Even when the Nazis were dropping missiles on London, this market never closed down. The European closed it, European Union bureaucrats closed it down for health regulation violations. Even though no one was sick, no one was ill, no one died, no one even claimed being sick from food they bought at this open air market in London that survived the Nazi blitz, but it did not survive the EU bureaucrats. And so, yeah, there is a parallel, because there are always parallels between any system that is based on centralized governmental power. The level of freedom in Europe and the U.S. Well, the late 19th century, I'd say there was much more freedom, certainly, because World War I and World War II, centralized power to a tremendous level. And so, not universally, I mean, you can always pick individual parts of society where they're more free than they are now, some that are less free than they are now. But I would say in terms of the government sticking to its constitutional function, the government of the U.S., it certainly stuck to them much more in the late 19th century than in the early 20th century. There's an article of mine on the web called The Last Good Democrat about Grover Cleveland. It's on lewrockwell.com. And he was pretty much the last American president who actually believed in the Jeffersonian idea of limited constitutional government. And it's all been downhill since then. And I think the same has occurred in Europe. Now, I can't answer this one about Kant, Hegel, and Popper. You'll have to ask David Gordon that question. That's his area. I'm merely an economist. Would Hayek classify the current political regime in America as socialist? Well, he would say it is at least half socialist. In The Road to Serfdom, he points out that as of 1928, the German economy, the German government, controlled about 53% of the German economy through nationalization. And almost all the rest of the German economy was so heavily regulated, he said, that the government essentially controlled the whole thing. You can make a similar argument in the U.S. If you look at statistics on government spending at all levels, federal, state, and local, as a percentage of total national income, it's about 40%. And of course, government is so pervasive in American business that you can make a very good case that the American economy is at least 60% or so socialist, if not more. And so I think that's what Hayek would say. It's 60 to 70% socialist. Yes, it's possible to watch the lecture later. They'll be archived. Get in contact with the administrators, Cam or Danny Sanchez. Do I think the USA will one day have a dictatorship? Well, we have a revolving dictatorship now. If we have a president of the United States who thinks that on a whim he can send missiles to any country in the world with drones, unmanned drones, without the consultation of Congress, without a declaration of war, then we've got a dictator. And we have a revolving dictator. A couple of years ago it was George W. Bush, now it's Barack Obama. You know, next year it'll be either Obama or apparently Romney. But they're essentially dictators already who pay no attention to the Constitution. And so it's not the same guy. It's not the type of dictator like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela who was there until he croaks. But we take turns. Our dictators take turns being dictator. The two major parties switch off by pretending to have legitimate elections in a couple of years. And the purpose of that is to fool the people into thinking that they actually have something to do with their government. Let's see, where was that? I'll go back to the chat and see what we have here. Still looking for more questions here. Okay, David Gray is asking about the section of Mein Kampf praising von Bismarck. I have an article on the web called Jaffa's Hitlerian Defense of Lincoln. It's on lewrockwell.com. Jaffa is J-A-F-F-A. Jaffa's Hitlerian Defense of Lincoln. And it's on lewrockwell.com, and I refer to the exact pages of Mein Kampf where Hitler praises not only Bismarck, but he praises Abraham Lincoln to the treetops. He alludes to Abraham Lincoln's first inaugural address, where Lincoln made the argument that the states were never sovereign, that somehow the Union created the states. The states didn't create the Union by ratifying the Constitution. That was Abe Lincoln's false theory, and Adolf Hitler paraphrased it and used it to make his case, Hitler's case, for abolishing states' rights in Germany in that same chapter. So, and I give chapter and verse and page number in the article of mine entitled Jaffa's Hitlerian Defense of Lincoln. I'll look for more questions here. Malcolm Arnold was asking a question about libertarians that understand that big capital will use its power in a laissez-faire system to prop up the state. Well, that's not capitalism. That's crony capitalism. Libertarians who advocate genuine capitalism oppose the collaboration of business and government. That's what fascism was. Fascism was the collaboration of business and government for the benefit of business and government at the expense of the public. And so libertarians who write on these subjects oppose that system. I've never met a libertarian who studied this who was unaware of this. And so it's just not true that libertarians are unaware of it. It's not just big capital either, it's small businesses. We do have, after all, a small business administration. Every time a Walmart enters an American city, which is a big corporation, big capital, all the little higher-priced mom-and-pop monopoly stores automatically file a lawsuit or try to get the city council to ban Walmart. So there's a lot of use of politics to create monopoly power by little businesses, too, who band together to screw their bigger competitors with the help of the government. And so it's not just big capital. And I don't know of any, there's no one associated with the Mises Institute that I've ever run across who is unaware of the fact that businesses of all sorts try to use the government to give themselves special advantages. That's what we are against. That's called economic fascism. That's not called capitalism. That's why we're advocates of capitalism, that we want to eliminate the possibility of that sort of thing happening. Let's see, I'll look for another question here. Yeah, there's my article. It's on the Independent Institute website also. Any chance of the U.S. returning to the true gold standard? I don't know. I couldn't bet on that. It all depends on what kind of collapse happens. Usually these sort of dramatic changes happen after some sort of financial collapse, and where maybe even a state or states will secede from the union and adopt a monetary system that is tied to gold, some kind of gold standard. There are all kinds of different types of gold standards, as much as one standard. And so I would not be surprised if that happened, but I can't make a prediction as far as that goes. Austin Carpenter is asking, how free are the modern Chinese markets? Have they changed since the Great Leap Forward? I think a case can be made that China has more economic freedom in much of China than there is here in the U.S. There's certainly more economic freedom in places like Singapore than there is in the U.S. And I had a student about 12 years ago who spent his junior year in China and came back saying there's more freedom to be an entrepreneur there than here. And I'm told he went back after he graduated to China to try to be an entrepreneur. So, I'm not an expert on the Chinese economy, but my impression is we're moving in the direction of more and more totalitarian control. With the Barney Frank banking bill, for example, and the reaction of the government to the crisis that it created, the Great Recession of 2007-2008, which we are still in, and China is moving in the opposite direction, more capitalism. Let's see. It's in the interest of Americans, the Chinese, to become more affluent, by the way, because that means more prospects for trade and exchange and less prospects for war. The more we trade with the Chinese, get to know them, and rely on them, the less likely that the neoconservatives will be successful in agitating for a war with China. They've been doing that for years and years and years. But, of course, China can shoot back, unlike most other countries that the neoconservatives want to pick wars with. Great detention of 2008. Okay. Let me see if there's any more questions. I'll go back to the Q&A. If we have any there. Renato, was Hitler trying to abolish the right to private ownership by persecuting the Jewish, I guess he means Jewish businessmen? One of the defining characteristics of socialism has always been abolition of private property. It's written in big black letters in the Communist Manifesto. And all varieties of socialism, whether it's called fascism or social justice, advocate at least an attenuation of private property. There's some kind of attack on private property. What fascism was, economic fascism was, it allowed private property, but it had to be heavily controlled and regimented in a way that that property would be used for purposes decided by the state. So the state would decide whether you're going to produce tanks or automobiles. And yeah, you can keep your factory, private property, but that property must serve the state, whereas in a real market economy, you serve the consumer, and the consumer is sovereign in a market economy, not the government. And so that's what made fascism fascism, is they allowed private property, unlike Soviet socialism, but it still had to serve the purposes of the state, not of the individuals in their role as consumers. Yeah. Okay, we seem to be running out of questions here. Let me see if I can get more in the chat, if there's anything else in the chat. Yeah, well, I guess David Gordon was contacted and chimed in here. I'm not too sure about Hitler and unions, but I'm sure unions were controlled by the government and weren't real, genuine unions as a result. that affects his economic policy. And so you can't have genuine unions to represent workers in a totalitarian state, because a union will be just a puppet of the government. So I've never really studied the labor unions in Nazi Germany, so I can't really answer that question. I don't know anyone who could. I could look it up for next week. Richard Evans, in the book The Third Reich in Power, deals with unions. Okay, there you go. That'll do it. Well, I guess I've got 8:16, so, and we seem to have run out of questions, so maybe we'll call it a night for now. Thank you all for participating, and thanks to Cam and the Mises Institute staff for helping us out. I think everything seems to have gone very smoothly. So I'll see you all next week. We'll continue on with the Road to Serfdom, and I hope I'll do my best to get you to learn a little more about the Road to Serfdom next week. So have a good night.